Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. From Wondery. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Great, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing good. We just got back from traveling and a bunch of stuff. It was really fun.
Yeah, and if you want to hear more about our little trip and what's been going on lately, we're releasing something on Patreon. So you might check that out, patreon.com/generationY. Now, I'd seen that Oxygen is releasing something March 28th and March 29th, 4-hour series on the West Memphis 3. I know that many of you are obsessed with this case. This case, even though there were convictions in it, those individuals, well, they did Alford pleas, right?
Yep.
And so they're out. Many believe them to be innocent or at least wrongly convicted. Now Oxygen is running this 4-hour series on it. It's titled The Forgotten West Memphis 3. It's apparently connected to the Truth and Justice podcast.
Bob Ruff.
So if you're interested in the West Memphis 3, Oxygen puts out pretty good stuff. That's March 28th and 29th on Oxygen, The Forgotten West Memphis 3.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge. The riveting adaptation of the best-selling true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone. Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
So, Aaron, we're talking about Marty Tankliff and how he was accused, found guilty, and sentenced for the murder of his parents. He's going to spend 50 years behind bars, pretty much a life sentence. What happens next?
Marty had a cousin who was his legal guardian and executor of his family's $3 million estate. His name is Ron Falby. He said that there was a blood-spattered letter on Seymour's desk addressed to Jerry Stuerman, and it was all about how he needed to pay his debt. The police never took this letter into evidence, so it's essentially not evidence. Well, we have no way of knowing the history of this letter because the police didn't take it. It's still very interesting, is it not?
I would call that exculpatory evidence. I would say that this would have been very valuable for the defense team to have during trial.
Part of this is a question because if Marty is, you know, forever tied to these murders, if he is spending 50 years in prison or more, he can't get the inheritance that he's owed because, as I say, it's illegal for a criminal to profit off of his or her crime. So in the meantime, this Tankliff estate goes to Sherry Rother, who is Marty's half-sister. She very much believed that Marty was guilty of the murders of his parents. Marty, of course, appeals. He and his attorneys are stating that he wasn't warned of his rights. And we already talked about this. If you're talking to them and you're saying, I want my attorney, and they're saying, well, no, and they're kind of hemming and hawing, and then you continue to talk to them about things, well, that becomes like a gray area for them anyway. Maybe not to many people in the public who are concerned about rights.
They look into the confession rate of this Suffolk County Police Department, and they have a 94% success rate for confessions. The average is more around 50%. So this police department has almost 100% confession rate, Aaron. And that bothers the defense attorneys and is another reason why they're looking at getting this appeal going and looking at their refusal to grant him counsel when he asked for it.
Well, they see a red flag, but Suffolk County would probably say, we're just good.
We're just that good. So what happens during these appeals? Because they point out a lot of issues here. They also start attacking the evidence about the murder weapons and how it obviously wasn't the knife or the dumbbell. They also point out that the mother was in the bedroom and the father was in the other room, the study, I guess. And there's no blood between the two crime scenes. The narrative is that he was going back and forth killing his parents using these same items. But now you're looking at it and thinking, there might have been two people doing this, being that there were multiple murder weapons used and no blood trails between the two crime scenes. It's just a lot of evidence that they're trying to point out in this appeals process.
The appeal, though, has to go through two levels of state courts and two levels of federal courts. The New York State Supreme Court in 1993 upheld it by a vote of 3-2. Looks like he loses 3-2 anytime it gets to an actual vote by the judges. That's not going to do him much good. And by 2001, he's out of appeals. And he's also penniless, basically. So at this point, even though he came from a very wealthy family, he needs attorneys who will do pro bono work, who won't expect to get any money.
So he has a childhood friend from high school who used to work with him at the bagel stores. And she was interning for Baker Botts law firm. She was discussing the pro bono work and suggested Marty's case to them. So when it finally went to the federal courts, these attorneys started to get involved to help Marty out pro bono. Then in 2001, Marty hears about a Long Island attorney named Bruce Barkett. This attorney has a polygraph administered to Marty, which he passes, and Marty has to give him a $5,000 fee to take on his case for the pro bono work. And this gets the ball rolling.
I think the most important thing, though, that comes out of contacting Barkett is that Barkett has a private investigator who works with him, Jay Saltpeter. And Jay Saltpeter is the kind of guy that can go and track down leads. And so he starts going through all the files, and he finds an interesting statement from a woman by the name of Carlene Kovacs. Now, Carlene, on Easter Sunday in 1991, attended a family dinner in Suffolk County. And while she was there, she heard a man talking about being involved in the Tankliff murders. This man's name was Joseph Creedon, and he was boasting about being involved. He said he hid in some bushes before and after the attack and had been covered in blood. So this is a very interesting lead. So at this point, they have to figure out, who is Joseph Creedon connected with? Because there's not a real strong connection there to anybody. So if he's boasting about being involved, they need to tie him in with other people. This happened in 1991, but the reason why there ended up being a note on it is because a few years later, she was encouraged to tell someone about this, you know, namely law enforcement. And so she went and talked to a retired police officer named Bill Navarra. Now, he was someone that she was familiar with, so she felt comfortable telling him about it. This information then went and got passed on to the attorney's office. Then it ended up in the hands of the Suffolk County District Attorney. But, you know, they followed up on this and they talked to Joseph Creedon. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. But still, this is an interesting lead. And what it's going to do is create another narrative. And it all grows from the seed of Creedon talking about being involved in the murders.
They also found a statement that Joseph Creedon had made. He said that he had spoken with Todd, who is Jerry's son, and Todd had approached him and asked him to cut out Marty's tongue. Now, Joseph refused to do this. Todd will end up shooting him in the arm. This is a weird conflict that happened between these two men. He then offered Joseph $10,000 to stay quiet about this whole ordeal. And he subsequently denied shooting Joseph, and nothing happened with this whole situation. He was not arrested, and nobody was questioned about this at the time. But later on, Todd was charged with selling cocaine out of his father's bagel shop. You know, Jerry's bagel shop, the bagel shops that might be fronts for other things. Yeah. But he was never found guilty of selling cocaine out of this bagel shop. It seemed as though that anything that Jerry's son Todd was doing, he had immunity from the police.
Now, if you don't think that Marty Tankliff was involved in the murders, and you're looking at how these two people were bludgeoned and slashed to death, then maybe it was more than one individual. Maybe. So the investigator, this private investigator, Saltpeter, is looking into Joseph and his list of crimes and the other people that have been arrested with him over time.
And he's finding that they're not being charged, and that specific investigator or police officer named McCready has a little bit more interaction with these guys.
One of the other names that are tied to Joseph is a man by the name of Glenn Harris. He has been tied to Joseph Creedon in a number of crimes. The investigator tracks down Glenn's mom, and she says her son is in prison. So the investigator says, I'm going to reach out to Glenn. And they end up setting up a meeting. In 2003, Glenn made a sworn statement that said that he drove Joseph and Peter Kent to the Tankliff home on the night of the murders. Now, this becomes interesting because according to the statement, they knew nothing about any murders. They just figured it was a robbery, which is what they were usually doing. They were thieves. Glenn waited in the car. The other men went into the home. And then when they came back out, he drove them away. He said he witnessed one of the men burn his bloody clothes in a fire.
They have a certain object on them, a bloody pipe that they go dispose of.
Well, apparently Glenn remembers where this was tossed.
A bloody pipe from what, 5-10 years before?
Oh no, this is 15 years or something. So the investigator goes out to this area. It's in some woods to look for this pipe. They think we'll take a metal detector. We'll look around. Maybe we'll hit pay dirt. Well, shoot. They're out there and
there's
a
pipe.
Yeah, they find it. But by it, I mean, they find a pipe. There's no evidence on it. So they can't say that it was used in the murders, but it's still interesting that someone who has implicated themselves in at least the, you know, assisting with the getaway with these other criminals, they're saying this is where the pipe was tossed. They find that pipe. So it's a possible murder weapon.
Now, after so many years, you're not going to have any evidence on that murder weapon. It's going to be washed away. But wow, why would these people even say these things? I mean, if we want to say that, why would Marty confess to a crime? Why would these people implicate themselves? And how are they able to say there was a murder weapon that was a pipe and it was tossed here and then they find a pipe exactly where they say it was? Meanwhile, all the evidence and autopsy reports say that a dumbbell would not have made the wounds, you know, the bludgeoning effect on his parents, but the pipe would. It's absolutely a smoking gun here. And no one seems to, or at least law enforcement and the courts don't really seem to be taking any of this seriously, but the private investigator and his legal team, Marty's legal team, they're on to something.
Further investigation did reveal some evidence that the prosecution and the police didn't want to bring forward, meaning they had the information, but they didn't think it was too important. This included a muddy footprint found in the area of the rear door, and also an impression of a bloody knife on a sheet. This was in the master bedroom where Arlene was found. But again, the shape of the knife didn't match the kitchen knife that they said was the murder weapon. So, Justin, when you find new evidence, meaning you have new testimony, you have new things that were not introduced at trial, things that put this whole case in a different light, that means the attorneys now have some new firepower. While they had exhausted their appeals, now they have something different and they can fight for Marty once again.
Well, and this is something that we learned from Ryan Ferguson's dad, is that you can't show all your cards on your first appeal, because if it gets shot down, you can't replay any of those cards. This is a whole new hand they've been dealt with, multiple witnesses and evidence. So they got another shot here.
Carlene and Glenn both passed polygraph tests.
If you care about them, I would say that they've at least been vetted, that they're not just making things up.
And they were willing to talk.
Again, why would two totally random people who really don't have anything to do with each other both come forward with these ideas and these stories? By the way, their stories match, whereas Marty's story about the crime doesn't match at all.
Marty's attorneys do something really, really clever. They get his story out in the media. They start pushing new information out across the news channels, and even 48 hours covered his case.
This is called public pressure. And sometimes if you can win the argument in the public, it will help you once you get to trial. Now, I don't know how true that is, but it's better than the prosecution putting out their theory to the public, because
they're going to do that, and they already have. So you have to counter that narrative. You have to fight this on more than one front.
Now, as part of the Tankliff case, some information was being dug up essentially by his attorneys, but it had been known, if anybody had bothered to read it, that in the 70s, and this is in 1979, the National Law Journal ran an article all about Suffolk County's use of interrogation techniques and about how they were coercing confessions.
Is that 94% rate?
The article talked about the use of physical force and other improper techniques to pressure suspects to confess, as well as failing to follow through on obvious leads. So this is really good because it's like they're being investigated by the media. So that information's out there, but they weren't really held to anything. So the problem wasn't fixed, but they were exposed. And now this can help Marty because now people can look back and go, wait, they had a confession from him, but how did they get that confession? Because, man, if you know how to put the right pressure on someone, maybe you can get them to say anything.
Well, some of that pressure was they would strike their suspects in the genitals. And that's how they would get some of their confessions. Well documented in this story, in this report.
As far as I recall, that came out in Newsday. They had analyzed a slew of cases in the 70s and into the 80s, and they're the ones that said, hey, they had a 94% success rate in confessions. They compared that with six other counties, and the highest percentage they could find among the other six counties was 73%. Now, the New York Supreme Court's appellate division reversed 10 murder convictions due to illegal tactics to get confessions. That's coercion. So the evidence is there that if they got a confession out of somebody and there isn't any physical evidence to tie them to the crimes, maybe it was coerced. And maybe they really need to stop giving these people the benefit of the doubt when it comes to closing a case based on a confession.
Now, in 1989, there was a state investigation report on McCready was found that he had knowingly gave false testimony during a murder trial. In May 2004, he had denied this to the New York Times. It was pointed out that he was never disciplined or prosecuted for any of his alleged misconduct. And he had always maintained that Marty was found guilty, so justice was carried out. He admits that he used trickery and deceit, but knows Marty did it.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements, I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, They give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Justin, it's legal for him to lie to a suspect.
Police lie to get suspects to admit and confess to crimes.
It's all a part of the interrogation. You have to get them talking, get them to say things that they don't want to just come out and say. And part of that is to lie to them. You suggest that you know things to be true that they don't actually have evidence of.
But it's weird that MacCready disregarded a lot of the evidence at the scene, and he wasn't even on duty at the time when Marty called 911 to report his parents' murder. It was weird that he would respond to this call and go to the scene and investigate.
I think he was the first detective on the scene, was he not?
Yes, he was.
He definitely had an interest in this case from the moment it broke. As soon as the word came out, he was there. July 2004, Marty starts to get good news. A series of hearings are held and evidence is gone over. And it takes about 18 months, 21 witnesses testifying. But now there's a new narrative that's building. And it has to do with the evidence that Jerry Stuerman was involved in the murders. And also that there's massive misconduct within Suffolk County. And that's why there was a confession, which was, of course, unsigned. So Saltpeter was a big part of this. He was there to testify about his investigation and all of the things that he had uncovered. What this does, though, is it really exposes how there truly wasn't any evidence tying Marty to these crimes. It was just this idea that it made sense. He was upset with his parents. He wanted their money. Well, guess what? That's not good enough. And in 2004 and on, more courts were starting to look at this like, yeah, what do you really have here on Marty? It's like he's finally being heard. And I think a big part of that, too, is you get the right people on your team. And Saltpeter, talk about invaluable. That guy was invaluable to his case.
During these hearings, Joseph was called to the stand. And, of course, he now denies any involvement, but he did say he would often collect debts from Todd's cocaine sales. So this is Jerry's son. And he insisted the worst he would do is punch somebody. However, the mother of his two children testified that he abused her and bragged about the torture he would commit upon these debtors. Joseph would go on to corroborate the police report that Todd asked him to cut out Marty's tongue. Yeah, all these statements that they've come across are now coming to light and are backed up by multiple people. He also admitted that he and Glenn had broken in and stolen from one of Jerry's bagel shops. Joseph's son testified that his father admitted to his involvement in the murders. Now, Glenn Harris had asked for immunity before testifying, but he was denied that weeks before the hearing. He testified anyways, but he invoked his Fifth Amendment to not self-incriminate. However, he did allow his prison chaplain to testify to the conversations that they had in regards to the case, and his chaplain would back up statements that Glenn had previously given. So again, we have multiple people that are all in the know about this murder. Multiple people that do not know each other, have zero connection, except for a lot of them were involved. We have a getaway driver. We have people that might have been the perpetrators of the crime who have all told other people about the crime. And now multiple witnesses have come forward to back up these statements. So they have over 20 witnesses testify for the defense.
Well, Joseph Creedon and Glenn Harris, the deal with them is, yeah, they were talking, they were telling people. Joseph made a full confession to his son about the crimes. And Glenn Harris you know, had talked. But when it came down to testifying, that's where they got nervous, because if they go down for these crimes, they're looking at murder. And right now, Marty Tankliff's on the hook. So, you know, it's easy to get cold feet. Glenn Harris, yeah, he was thinking about testifying, but the good news, he did allow the chaplain to talk. The other thing that comes out of these hearings is that there's testimony, one of which is by Leonard Lubrano. He owned a restaurant, testifying that there is a connection between Jerry Stuerman and Detective McCready, meaning these guys are kind of buddies. They spent time together and people knew about it. But of course, if you're trying to sell someone as a murderer at a trial, and there's any chance that that relationship could upset your chances of winning that trial, yeah, you want to deny. And well, it turns out McCready and Stuerman, they're friends.
The guy that should have been the prime suspect in this murder was cleared as a suspect by the lead investigator, who was off duty that day, decided to get involved with this murder case and clear his best friend or his buddy. Got it.
Turns out to be his card playing buddy.
Oh, nice.
So poker was a major factor here, because it really explains the relationships in the case.
Now, some of these other witnesses that backed out of testifying, a lot of them said that they had pending charges, and if they did testify and implicate themselves, it would be a compounded charge against them. So that's why they would back out of testifying at the last minute. But mysteriously, after they wouldn't testify, all those charges against them would be dropped. Let that sink in. They're not going to testify against Jerry or for Marty in his defense, because they say they have pending charges. And then after they ghost the defense team, those charges are dropped.
Now, all of this evidence, all these hearings, all this information comes through and ends up in the hands of a judge who's going to make a determination. March 17th, 2006, despite all this information, the judge upheld Marty's convictions. Now, in his ruling, he stands by the prosecution, who had argued that these witnesses aren't credible. You know, they're criminals, which is funny because who else would be involved in the murders, right? But again, it looks like Marty's case is shot down. The amazing thing, though, just the next day, more people start coming forward and saying, I have something to tell you. One of those people is Glenn Harris's wife. And she said, oh, he told me all about the attacks. He told me, he told his mom. And again, all this information starts coming forward. So it's almost like, as fate would have it, despite this appeal going down, despite all this evidence being shot down, a lot more people are coming forward and going, ah, no. Wait a minute.
We're sick and tired of watching this play out over and over again. And this poor kid, who is now an adult, is sitting behind bars. Maybe they're not doing it for the good of Marty, but they're just coming forward.
January 2007, the defense team submitted a 157-page appeal to the Appellate Division of the New York State Supreme Court. And they had several friend of the court briefs that supported Marty's bid, meaning there's a lot of support building for Marty to be released. This is, I guess, pretty significant. Despite all the problems Marty's had, it is now looking like too many people are standing behind him. It's, you can't ignore it at this point.
They're not only appealing his case, but they're going after the district attorney and multiple agencies that have kept Marty behind bars.
Part of the support comes from 31 former federal, state, and local prosecutors, state and federal judges, innocence groups, other defense attorneys, and even 54 of Marty's high school classmates, and not to mention he still has the support of almost every single member of his family, both sides of his family, apart from his half-sister. It's now such a large group standing behind him that it's going to get the attention of people that can make a difference. Like you said, Justin, they go after the Suffolk County District Attorney. They're accusing him of prosecutorial misconduct. There's just so much that we'd have to go through to explain all this. But all it is more people coming forward and saying, here are these people. They were together. They were involved. And it's the same names. You know, it's Glenn Harris. It's Joseph Creedon. It's Jerry Stuerman. And of course, McCready.
And all of their statements match. Again, it's not like Marty got some of the details wrong and then some of these less than desirable people came forward and said, oh, I did it, but didn't give any details. No, all of their stories match. And if you don't understand the weight of that, then you shouldn't ever be a juror. You should never be a judge. You should never work in the legal system because this is overwhelming evidence in Marty's favor.
I think, you know, if we wanted to sum this up in a way that anybody listening could understand, they were able to show without question that McCready let some of these people off the hook consistently. He was involved in their cases when they were arrested for burglary and other crimes. And that's where it ended. So do you want to question McCready? Oh yeah. Major, major credibility issues on McCready's part.
And McCready was not liked by most of the police force. So they knew he was corrupt. They knew he was a bad cop. They didn't call him out for it, but he didn't have a lot of friends on the police force. So this is all him doing these things on his own.
December 21st, 2007, the Appellate Division of the New York Supreme Court voted unanimously to vacate Marty's convictions. This is a 21-page decision. And what's crazy about it is all the way up to that point, all of his appeals, everything was shot down. Everybody, every judge, it seemed like, that had the power to reverse this kept siding with the prosecution. This time, this appellate court said, it is abhorrent to our sense of justice and fair play to countenance the possibility that someone innocent of a crime may be incarcerated or otherwise punished for a crime which he or she did not commit. It appears that the county court never considered that the cumulative effect of the new evidence created a probability that, had such evidence been received at the trial, the verdict would have been more favorable to the defendant. The county court, in effect, applied a blanket disqualification for all of the defendant's proffered evidence. And you know what? The way to sum that up is, we say it all the time, the court can decide that your evidence isn't good.
Yeah.
Or that it doesn't matter. Or it doesn't override the effect of the jury's decision. But here, the appellate court is saying, no, this is massive evidence that Marty wasn't involved. And the prior courts just denied him any chance to use it.
They rubber stamped and just had this finality to his guilty verdict. And his lawyers would say that they would hand over these huge, you know, reports and just, you know, hundreds of pages of documents, and the judges and everybody, they wouldn't even look at it. They'd just go, oh, eh, we're upholding this. And there wasn't even enough time to pass that they could have read any of the documentation. Whereas in this appellate court, when Marty's lawyers stood up to speak, the judges on the panel said, you don't have to say anything. You can sit down. We already know what we're going to do. And his defense attorneys were like, well, we kind of have to justify us being here. So let's just say, here I am. And thank you for considering our, you know, report and statements. So, yeah.
It's like having a lot to say and no one ever wants to hear you. And all of a sudden, one day, you have a bunch of people are saying, no, we see it. We understand. What a relief, eh? But yeah. It's like you've been wanting to talk this whole time. No one would listen. And now people are literally saying, the judges, it's okay. No, we get it.
the ultimate gaslighting for, what, 17 years that Marty's been behind bars and his lawyers have been fighting this. They've just been denied over and over and over again, saying nothing you give us is good enough. And then all of a sudden one day, oh, here we go. Yeah, we're good.
It's 6 days later when Marty's family posts his bail. He's released. It's a $1 million bail. He gets out. He is overwhelmed. He's with his family. Everybody's hugging. But the Suffolk County prosecutor is saying, we're going to take him to trial again.
They can retry him. They're thinking about it. Luckily, though, on January 2nd, 2008, the district attorney announced that he would drop the charges against Marty and actually asked the governor to appoint a special prosecutor to reinvestigate the case. They said that it was no longer possible to reasonably assert that the case against Marty Tankliff would be successful. And they firmly believed that the various theories advanced as to who may be responsible for the murders are just not supported by the credible evidence. Nevertheless, for legal and factual reasons, the prosecution against the defendant is over. So they're not admitting that they're wrong here, Aaron. They're saying we just couldn't win if we took them back to trial. But they're saying that they don't believe all the other theories. Am I reading that right?
It almost, I know that, you know, the district attorney could answer this better than we could, but from where I'm sitting, it sounds like they're saying, okay, yeah, you kind of got us on this. So we essentially are asking someone else to investigate it because you've let our convicted man go and you've shown that apparently our case isn't good enough to keep him. So someone else will have to investigate this, which is, you know, out of all the cases that we've covered, that's actually pretty good because a lot of these prosecutors don't want to back down. And when they do have to back down, they do so with kind of a snarl. Well, this time it seems like they're just like, well, someone else will have to look into this then.
I felt the snarl in that statement.
You did?
Yeah.
Are you talking about when they say that the various theories advanced as to who may be responsible for the murders are just not supported by the credible evidence?
Yeah.
I get that. I mean, again, they don't want to admit they're wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that's their way of doing that. In other words, this is your call. You know, you didn't agree with our call, but it's our call. That's how we see it. But do they really believe it themselves? I think what they did was they took the case that they could bring to court and pushed it. And you can blame MacCready for that because MacCready was covering for Jerry, his poker playing buddy.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
This is where we go from what's called a wrongful conviction to a frame job. And if you listen to Marty or his attorneys, they will say Marty wasn't murdered that night. He was left to be caught and prosecuted as the perpetrator of this crime. That's scary to think they left the son alive because they knew MacCready was going to come in and peg him as the murderer.
Yeah, if he had been harmed or killed, their case just gets more difficult. Now, if he's dead, he didn't do it. So who did? Now they have to look elsewhere.
Now they have to go look at Jerry.
And he wasn't harmed. So the police show up and they're investigating, and here's this kid with no emotion. There's video of him just sitting there. No emotion. He doesn't look like he's worried about anything. Of course, Marty would explain it as he was in shock. But if you just look at that, I could see a lot of people saying, well, maybe he was involved. He doesn't look like he cares. This is how our perception can ruin a case for us. If we see something wrong, well, maybe we won't understand it correctly. You're judging someone without knowing them.
So just a week later, in 2008, Governor Eliot Spitzer appointed a special attorney general to look at the Tankliff case and conduct his own investigation and prosecute anyone who was found to be responsible for the crimes.
It's in July of 2008 when the attorney general's office filed a motion to drop charges against Marty Tankliff. This is significant because, you know, we say, well, even when the prosecution backs down, they're still saying, well, the alternate theories don't make sense. Well, now the attorney general's office is saying there is some evidence that others may have committed the killings, though not enough to prosecute them. So it's not like a full exoneration here, but they're saying there's definitely doubt.
Well, I just love how there's not enough evidence to prosecute him, even though they have multiple eyewitnesses, multiple people giving statements that all corroborate each other, yet they had enough to prosecute Marty, who gave a confession that didn't match anything, didn't sign said confession, and there was zero evidence tying him to the actual murder scenes, but they don't have enough to go after these other people. I'm just, again.
Yeah, fair point. But I think this is just further evidence that they don't really want to back off and say we were wrong. That's the best way to describe this.
And this doesn't sit well with Marty. And in 2009, he's going to file a civil rights lawsuit against the police department and various detectives, including McCready. And in 2010, Marty also filed a lawsuit against the state of New York for his wrongful conviction. And he will be successful with that lawsuit and win $3.3 million. So over $3 million. Now, McCready will end up passing away in 2016. His name is still on the lawsuit, although it sucks because he would never see any sort of justice there.
Well, I mean, do we really think that anything would really happen to McCready? I mean, that kind of stuff is so rare.
Yeah.
That it's hard to imagine anything would have happened to him. But, you know, a judge did rule that there was a motion to dismiss the suit because of McCready dying. This judge, Joanna Siebert, she refused to dismiss it because she said there was forensic analysis which showed there was no blood on the purported murder weapons, no blood found in the shower, the drains, the traps, as well as, you know, she was talking about Jerry's suspicious behavior, Jerry Stuerman. This is just, these are judges really paying attention and following through on the evidence instead of the narrative.
So this lawsuit will award Marty with another $10 million. So all in all, he receives over $13 million as a result for his wrongful conviction and 17 years he spent behind bars. I don't think anyone of us would volunteer to spend 17 years behind bars for $13 million.
You say that, but there are people that would. Well, but I know what you mean. I wouldn't want to do that.
The people that would have never been to prison. you would think that doing the job right would be the motivation. And even a settlement of over $13 million doesn't seem to really change anything. And it sucks because I want to see change. I want to see progress.
It doesn't come out of the district attorney's pocket or the attorney general's pocket.
Or the investigators' benefits or pensions or anything that is, you know, going to actually hurt the people that were involved and had a hand in this.
It's the public who essentially foots this bill. That's why it, you know, when you don't hold people accountable, which making them pay out of the, you know, with these lawsuits and everything, it doesn't hold anyone accountable. Yeah, it looks bad in the papers, but they don't care. You know, Justin, one of the things you and I talked about is there are different cases where people are wrongfully convicted. And, you know, who's to say what kind of life you live after you get out of prison, after serving 10, 20, whatever years for a crime or crimes you didn't commit. But this case really stands out because Marty, you know, who word had it, maybe didn't seem business inclined back when, he had vowed to become an attorney while he was in prison. What happened with that?
Well, he went and got his law degree, and now he helps exonerate other wrongfully convicted inmates. Now, he is backed up by multiple law firms. They have a, I would say, an extremely stringent vetting process for people that apply for their help. But man, this guy is just gone on. He started teaching at universities and he's written a book.
And works as an attorney for Metcalf and Metcalf. He actually was admitted to the New York State Bar in February of 2020. Now, how did he do this? I mean, you would think a guy that was wrongfully convicted, was beaten down by the system over and over and over again, you would think he would have lost hope. But, you know, in his interviews, if you watch them, Marty credits his family for sticking by him. He always knew that almost everyone had his back. They didn't doubt his innocence. And beyond that, he said that he credits his wife, Lori, and his daughter, Courtney, for his perseverance in finishing his law degree. Because that's not something you just go and get on in a year or two. This is a long, long journey. And he completed it. But as we learned in this case, you don't always do it on your own. And that's what Marty's story is all about is, you know, he was never alone. He always had his family there and later his wife and then a daughter. What did you take away from this case, Justin?
I watched a lot of interviews with Marty and his lawyers. I watched people question Marty and even say, how do we know that you really didn't do this? He never shows any sign of impatience. He's always very gracious with everybody he talks to. And his behavior after the exoneration, it shows me that this guy had passion and drive, and now they've created this man and given him a purpose, which is to do good in life. And if anyone thinks that this guy actually did kill his parents, well, it doesn't matter, because the good he's doing in this world far outweighs whatever you think about him.
And I would say for those of you who say if Jerry Stuerman and these other people were involved in the murders, why didn't they prosecute them? We only have to look over at MacCready. MacCready's the reason why this was done the way it was done. He was friends with Jerry, and he made sure that Jerry was cleared. Once that happened, and they had this whole narrative of Marty killing his parents for the money and he was sick and tired of them, it's such a ridiculous thing. Marty and his parents, no matter what kind of arguments they had, the reason the family stuck with him is because they knew every family has difficulties, but there was love there. And Marty sure as hell appreciated the life he had. And it was because he had good parents. So at the end, truth won out. You know, this false narrative that Marty had killed his parents, it didn't work. And it kind of gives hope, I think, to other people who are sitting wrongfully convicted in prison right now. If Marty, who had every chance of an appeal, everything was shot down, denied over the years, if he can get out, and not through some sort of pardon, but actual judges saying, no, we get it, this is all wrong, then there's hope for anyone else who's in the same situation. It's going to take a group effort. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.